Okay. That's right. So I will show you recent results that we've obtained using chandra data to study the KuCo properties of high redshift clusters. And by high redshift, I mean up to redshift 1.3. And this is work done together with Paolo Tozzi and Piero Rosati, mainly. So this was my introductory slide, but we don't really need it anymore at this point. I just want to jump to this part here, where I mentioned the current status, so what we know on the evolution of KuCos across redshift. And so there are many studies on the fraction of KuCos in the local universe, and we know that the local universe is dominated by KuCo clusters with a fraction of at least 50%. This fraction doesn't seem to evolve up to redshift 0.4. And at higher redshift, there are a bit of tension with these two results by Riclidon and collaborators that claims a strong evolution, and our result from 2 years ago that claims that there is a moderate evolution, but in fact that there are no indication of strong KuCo clusters at high redshift. So we investigated this issue more in detail, and this is what I'm going to show you here today. So we measured the evolution of KuCo clusters out to redshift 1.3. We used three representative samples that were observed with chandra, covering the redshift range from 0.1 to 1.3. And I'm going to show you the results that we've obtained using the surface brightness concentration, the central entropy, and the central cooling time. And then I will show you in the second part of this talk, which has to be very fast, I'm going to show you really new data, very deep data, chandra data that we've obtained for cluster warps 14, 15 at redshift 1. And this is work which is still ongoing. And I will show you its surface brightness profile, but more importantly, the temperature and metallicity profile and the temperature map, and also that there is a radio source that is resolved with VLA. So just a glimpse on the data that we used for the study, the measurement of the evolution of KuCos after redshift 1.3. We used a sample drawn from the 400 square degrees survey as our local sample, so 26 clusters, then two high redshift samples, the high redshift end of the 400 square degree survey, and a merged sample, which is the RDCS and the warps, that reaches the highest redshift. So we go to out to the redshift 1.3. This is our first result, probably the most important one, because so at high redshift, the data that we have has poor signal. And so we don't want to get very fancy diagnostics to evaluate the KuCo strength. And in 2008, we defined this surface brightness concentration parameter, which is very simple. It's just aperture photometry of the surface brightness within two radii. And I show you here the distribution of CSB for the local sample shown in black and for the distance sample shown in red. And so it's quite clear that as CSB increases, which is characteristic, so strong CSB is characteristic of strong KuCos, we see that at high redshift, we don't really have clusters with very high CSB. But what we do see is that most distant clusters, they kind of cluster here in this intermediate CSB range, which is in between a non-KuCo and a strong KuCo. So this is our first result showing the lack of strong KuCos, but this intermediate KuCo regime at high redshift. Then we also measure the central entropy or pseudo-entropy, which is something that a lot of people do, so we thought it would be interesting to do it. However, there's a caveat here because we are using always one temperature, single cluster temperatures, so that we are in the same conditions between the low redshift sample and the high redshift sample, so that we can perform a direct comparison. Because obviously, for these high redshift clusters, we do not have temperature profiles. And so I would like to avoid using sharp thresholds to say what is a KuCo and what is not a KuCo. So Mark Voigt was showing his plot that I think it was with K20, well, here I use a radius of 20 kiloparsec, which is what the data allows, but central entropy with below 30 keV per square centimeter, something like that, then if a cluster has this entropy, then it's a KuCo, otherwise it's not. Well, here we cannot really use these values just like that. So I think it's more interesting to compare the shape of the distributions of K20 And again, we see the same thing, that the local sample spans a very broad range of K20, whereas the distant sample is kind of confined here to this intermediate regime. And logically, we see the same thing in the central cooling time, which is, I think, the quantity most often used to evaluate the cool core strength. And again, the local sample spans a very broad range of central cooling times. The distant sample is in this gray area. And here I plot the age of the universe at the cluster redshift, so today, sorry, the current age of the universe, because cool cores are defined as having a cooling time, a central cooling time, which is shorter than the age of the universe. But so, of course, that for distant clusters, we cannot take this at face value. And so we normalize this cooling time by the age of the universe at a cluster redshift. And so then things shift quite a bit. Now, if we compare here, we would see, we'd say, well, most distant clusters are cool cores. And then if we see this plot, we say, well, most distant clusters are non-cool cores. But I think the truth lies in between, because the quantity that we really need here is the age of the clusters. And this is something that we don't know, because clusters do not come with a birthday. So I think probably the best thing to do with this low signal-to-noise data of high redshift clusters is to use something simpler, like CSB, the surface brightness concentration, which is a phenomenological parameter, but does correlate strongly with the central cooling time. And so I think it's preferable to use this and not, and avoid using these sharp thresholds in entropy or in central cooling time or whatever. So just to summarize this part here, we conclude from our study that there is a moderate evolution of the cool core fraction out to redshift 1.3. We do confirm a lack of strong cool cores, but still most of these distant clusters are what we term moderate cool core clusters. We also don't see any sign of the cool core, non-cool core bimodality that sometimes people claim to see in entropy. We don't see it. Something which may be of interest and I didn't have time to mention is that there is no radio data available to actually study a correlation between the central radio galaxy and the X-ray cool core properties of the distant clusters. And this is actually something that now Paolo Tozzi is taking the lead to investigate with some VLA time. And I didn't mention this also, but the 400 square degree sample, the high redshift part, we found it to be skewed to low concentrated clusters. And so we decided to use the RDCS and the warps to measure evolution, because this merged sample has a more diverse morphology, so to speak. So the dynamical range in surface brightness is larger. So just to kind of introduce the next topic. So based on this study, we selected the strongest cool core cluster in our sample at high redshift to investigate its cool core properties in detail. And we were lucky enough to get deep Chandra data last year. So this is WARPS 1415 at redshift 1. The archival ACSI data showed us that this cluster is massive, has a temperature of 7 keV, it's quite luminous. The central cooling time is 3.9 gigayears, but again, taking a single cluster temperature. And the CSV puts this cluster in borderline between moderate and strong cool core. So this was our ideal target. We got this 280 kiloseconds with Chandra. And so we now have 8,000 counts, which allows us to make a spatially resolved analysis of this cluster. And on the other hand, even though I'm not going to mention this, I think it's very interesting to note that this cluster also has a very bright, very massive BCG that actually shows some O2 emission. So this is a very interesting cluster at high redshift to study the cool core properties in a multi-wavelength way. So this is a surface brightness profile. This is just to show you that it's very clear. We need a second component to capture the cool core. And this is probably the most interesting plot of the talk. Here we have a temperature profile of the cluster that shows a temperature drop towards the cluster core, just like in local cool core clusters. And here we have the metallicity profile that has this. Granted, the error bars are large, but still the central metallicity is larger than the solar value. So this, I think, hasn't been shown at high redshift before. I show you here some comparison with local clusters. So this cluster at redshift 1 shows a temperature drop and dipping, very similar to KuCore clusters. Thank you. In the local universe, and particularly this metallicity peak is probably telling us that the enrichment mechanisms took place very fast, and that transport mechanisms did not have time to push out to drive away the metals from the core to the outskirts of the cluster. And here is a temperature map, which is it's highly smoothed. It's not, I mean, the regions were not really independent, but still it gives us shows us what's happening here. This is the temperature from 4 to 14 keV. And additionally, we find something quite interesting, is that there is a radio source coincident with this with the cluster center. Here I show you these are VLA contours of this radio source, hinting at a jet light feature. And so I show you now here a bit better. This is on the left is the VLA data showing this very compact source, and then this jet-like feature, and this is the Chandra data. The jet is 80 kiloparsec across. We tried very hard to look for cavities, but it was very challenging. But we are still working on this. So let's see what happens. And so to wrap it up, cluster Warp 14, 15 is indeed a KuCore cluster at redshift 1. And we use the deepest Chandra data of a distant cluster to measure the surface brightness profile. So we showed that we do need a central beta model component to actually capture the KuCore. And we will be doing more work on this to measure the surface brightness profile in different sectors to try to see if there is indeed some hints of cavities. We see a temperature drop, which is similar to the ones that we see in local KuCore clusters. We have a very high iron peak in the center. So this will be valuable to give us some timescales on the enrichment mechanisms of the ICM at high redshift. And we do have a radio source in the center and some O2 emission in the BCG. So this cluster is also the ideal, I think, high redshift cluster to study the KuCore phenomenon at high redshift. We study different components of the KuCore phenomenon, so in different wavelengths. And that's what I wanted to show. Thank you.
Thank you. So let's start with a couple of questions for our present speaker and then shift into general discussion.
I think your classification scheme that involves moderate and strong KuCore clusters really makes a lot of sense. And it's also consistent with what we see in numerical simulations with some ENSO simulations we published a few years ago, in the sense that the KuCores in this merger hierarchical picture form fairly early. And over time, those clusters that experience only minor mergers, the incoming subclusters actually donate more cool gas into the central regions. And so over time, the cool cores get stronger. Mm. And so that is consistent with what you're finding observationally. So it's good that you have differentiated, I think, between these moderate and strong cool cores.
Well, it was kind of obvious from the distributions that I showed you at the beginning, for example, on CSP, that you cannot just say yes or no, because I mean most decent clusters are in the gray area, so required.
If you remember well your paper, it seemed to me that your result depend on which sample, IRESHI sample, is used. You briefly mentioned to that.
Right.
You can remember and explain a little bit this point.
Well, basically what we found is that the 400 square degree survey has is more skewed towards having, this plot shows you, having less concentrated clusters. So here is the we fitted beta models to the data. So these are the two samples, the 400 square degree high redshift sample and the merged RDCS plus warp sample. And here you see that they, I mean, the morphology of these clusters populates different parts of the plot. So apparently the 400 square degree sample lacks concentrated clusters. That's what we concluded.
So the question is, why? Right. So the selection of those two samples were rather similar, right? And you're seeing, you know, at high redshift, the high surface brightness, moderate cool, whatever you call it, cool core clusters are popping out. They're easier to see. They're the first things you pick out in any X-ray survey will be something that is centrally concentrated. So the question is, how are the two surveys different in their selection that the
that would be
you'd have this change? And your trend there is also kind of driven by one or two points, you know, in
the
two distributions look rather similar.
Well, here's the distribution of CSB for the two samples. They are statistically different.
So the main question I'm posing is, how are those? They're selected with rather similar X-ray selection techniques.
Well, this I cannot reply.
One sample lack of concentrated clusters, but you might also conclude that the other sample lack of diffuse clusters.
It's true, but I wanted a sample which is representative and which, you know, covers a wide range of morphologies. So if I have a sample that has a smaller surface brightness dynamical range, why would that be representative if then I have another one which spans a higher or a larger surface brightness range? And I mean, we do see that for cluster 14-15 at redshift 1 is indeed a cool core cluster. So if I accept this result from the 400 square degree survey, I would say there are no cool core clusters at high redshift, and indeed there are.
Alexei?
Yeah. So I just wanted to comment, if the suggestion from this plot is somehow, you know, compact clusters are missing from 400 square degrees, it's not true. We, in the overlapping area above the same flux limit, we cross-compared, you know, RDCS warps, 400 square degrees. There were no cases where the clusters was missing from 400 square degrees simply because it was compact. Okay, so if you compare above the same flux limit, you find one-to-one correspondence. An indirect evidence, if you look at the X-ray luminosity functions from all these surveys, in the overlapping range of luminosities, they agree so nicely. It was a, you know, review paper from Stefano and Piero, you know, that showed that. So if this difference is real, we simply might be looking at a X-ray flux or X-ray luminosity or mass effect. So in 400 square degrees, the X-ray flux cut was high.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking only at the most luminous object of these redshifts, most massive objects of these redshifts. If there is a trend for cool core fraction or compactness to increase for low mass systems, you would expect something like this.
But then...
Okay, so I'm saying that the difference, if it's real, then it should have a physical explanation rather than the explanation in terms of selection of the sample.
Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, the goal of this paper was not to discuss the two samples.
Despite the fact that there seems to be a continuous range of surface brightness concentration, the radio halos show that there's a dichotomy based on this concentration parameter that the concentrated clusters do not have radio halos. And so something physical happens when the concentration gets too low. So there hopefully will show up some break at some point where we'll see there's some critical concentration.
You're talking about low redshift systems. Yeah.
All right. Now, I don't want Andy and Brian to feel neglected. So while you're welcome to continue to ask questions on the present on the presentation here up right now, feel free to expand the discussion.
Well, one of the questions I had was, we first heard that there had to be in one sample very little duty cycle of the central radio sources, that there was basically they had to be 100% on. And then we heard for a somewhat different sample, I think at different redshift, that the radio sources could not always be on, could either speaker say something more about that? I don't know. I'd like to hear more about that.
So who would like to answer that one? Andy?
I'm going to pass to Brian, because if he's here. But what I was telling you was correct for a sample of low redshift clusters, which are, you know, ones where the central cooling time is less than 3 gigayears. I think Brian is referring to a more general collection of clusters. Okay, so the ones where you need heating because there's rapid radiative cooling are the ones where there's 100% radio central radio source. Generally, when you look at clusters, that's not true.
Exactly. If I wasn't clear, the clusters that we were looking at in the 400 square degree are not selected in the same way as the clusters Andy's talking about. So those are the big cooling flows that have very short cooling times in the center. And what we're finding in the more distant clusters that tend to have lower luminosities is that we're not measuring the cooling time. So what we're finding is that the on time, the fraction of objects that have bright radio sources, is consistent with a more general population. So they are, and it's consistent with the overall argument that I made, and I think Joanna just made, which is that there are fewer, not that there are none, that was the one thing that I, it doesn't mean that there are no large cooling flows at high redshift, it just means that there are fewer of them than there are today. And it's a matter of strength. So we don't know whether these all could have moderate, they could have Ming Sun's coronae in them, which are driving gas in, and in fact they could be fed by a feedback loop. But what I tried to argue is we don't have evidence that that's true. So it's either a feedback loop that's not as tightly coupled as in the systems that Andy showed, or it could be that it's just general AGN heating, that there is not a feedback loop there. We don't know the answer to that, and that's something that we need to figure out in the next few years.
Okay, so a question to Brian and Joanna. I'm sitting over here. So we and also others have quantitatively shown that the fraction of cool core clusters, at least in flux-limited low redshift samples, is significantly biased compared to the true underlying fraction. Now, when you do the comparison to the low and high redshift samples, one has to calculate the bias for both of the samples. It might be a different bias. So the question is, has that been done? Or?
It's hard to know. So at least in my case, the honest answer is no. And the reason is it's very hard to know not just, you know, what the bias is, but what the sign of the bias would be. And so, for example, you know, I would think that in these high redshift samples, we would be more likely to detect, you know, these are flux-limited samples, and so the things that are bright in the X-rays are going to pop into your sample more quickly than the things that are faint. And my initial thinking when we started that survey was that we're going to end up being biased toward detecting cooling flows rather than against it, because they're brighter, they're easy to detect, and they are not point-like, they're extended. I think Alexei and Brennan showed that very nicely. They are extended in ROSAT images, so my sense was that we'd be biased positive, and I thought we'd detect all kinds of, you know, emission lines, which always are a very nice and sensitive probe of cooling gas, or at least of short cooling times, and the fact is we didn't. So I don't know why we would be biased against detecting them, whereas in, say, the BCS, they're biased for detecting them. But it, you know, in terms of the comparison, one thing's for sure, there are very few strong emission line objects. The greater issue of whether this is an evolutionary effect is something that we still need to look into. It's not clear, you know, when we compare to nearby samples, there could be selection biases there that are getting us. And that I don't have a definite answer to, but I don't know why we would be biased in that way.
So one of the biases, and Thomas probably referred to that, was that in cooling flow clusters you have excess X-ray luminosity, so you can detect them to larger distances in the low redshift sample, so you can overestimate the fraction of strong cooling flow clusters. So that bias, we estimated, is comparable to the low redshift sample and to the high Z high redshift sample.
Hi, I wanted to ask Brian a little bit about the doing the preheating with the AGN. From what Mark was saying earlier, I think that the amount of heat that you need to put in to match the entropy profiles depends a lot on the redshift at which you put the heat in. Okay, and I just wondered, you know, when you're doing it with the AGN, presumably you're putting the heat in at lower redshifts, and therefore it might be harder to get the right effect. Did you take that into account?
All right. Well, so I mean, it wasn't done in that fashion. So basically, you know, what we did was measure the radial luminosity, run that through the scaling relation that tells you how much jet power there is per radial photon, and that scaling factor is of order 80 or so, and that tells you how much total energy was being dumped in to the intercluster medium. Then you add up all of the gas mass within a certain radius. And you get a number of particles that are there, and then you use that to estimate the heating rate per particle. That's as simple as it is. And from that, you get a number in KeV per particle, and it turned out to be a number that is interesting.
So I just have a few quick comments actually on these subjects. First thing is the results that I think Adam Mance may talk about a little later in the week, which is for the MAX survey, the bright MAX survey, which are the most massive X-ray brightest, most X-ray luminous clusters we know about between a redshift of 0.3 and 0.5. We see a large fraction of very massive cool quartz, about 40%, just like Carolyn got in the BCS and Franz Bauer got from an expanded sample. So we see no absence of really big cooling flows from the 0.3 to 0.5 redshift range. Just a few quick comments. I completely agree that selection effects are subtle and need to be modeled, certainly along with the population itself, the underlying population, to get these answers out properly. We do, Adam, Gus, and I do talk about this a little bit in our review article, but it is a challenge moving forward to actually do that job with a little more sophistication, thinking about the Eddington and Malmquist biases and their impact on the properties that you measure. The one last quick comment would be to remember that just as when we're working with scaling relations, the physical radius at a redshift of 1 of 20 kiloparsecs does not correspond to the same overdensity as it does at a redshift of 0. And so one should also take account of those effects in gauging, say, what the entropy evolution is.
I would like to comment a little bit on the same lines. One of the things is, I think the two samples in terms of the flux bias that Thomas was addressing should be very similar. We looked at that for scaling relations recently. So I think the flux selection effect should not make them too different. And the other comment I want to make, if you compare cooling flows at high distance, at large redshifts to nearby, you have this problem that Steve Allen just addressed, that you are comparing clusters at a high, which are formed at higher overdensity, or the universe has a higher overdensity. The way to look at it is actually, when Joanna showed both, she showed nicely the distribution of the central entropies and of the cooling times. So what's actually happening is you shouldn't scale the cooling flows to higher overdensity of the universe, because it's a physical, an astrophysical region. You have a similar property, or the feedback stops the cooling flow from getting a higher gas density or lower cooling down at the same level. So these cooling flows look physically the same as the moderate cooling flows nearby. So they are not scaled with E of Z like the whole cluster itself. They are physically very similar, and this is why the cooling times are similar but not don't have the same ratio to the universe. So they are more in a transitional state, but physically, and that makes a lot of sense what Joanna was showing, physically they are very similar to nearby cooling flows in terms of their density, their cooling times, and they are not scaled by the cosmological scaling parameters.
So I guess that with Steve's comment and Hans's comment, it goes back to the issue that Mark raised at the very beginning, that there is a tension between what scales to make comparisons on, physical scales, cosmological scales. And you may be wondering why I've decided to take over the speaker's podium. It's because I've been told that we have to wrap up. So thank you very much, and we'll continue after lunch.